Hey, Peter.
Hey, Jonah. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So we're both back in the office from the snow and ready to do a blogging hit.
Yeah, I in fact have an office now. I haven't had an actual office outside of my cave in 11 years. I'm at the American Enterprise Institute now. I haven't left National Review, but I'm a visiting fellow or piss boy or something. I don't know my exact title quite yet, but it's nice to be here. And
I hear the AI cafeteria is kind of the place to be seen if you're a conservative in Washington.
It's turned into that. It wasn't quite like that when I was here. Mm-hmm. We had a separation between dining room and cafeteria back then, back in the early 90s, before we all became warmongers.
Now you're still warmongers, huh? No, actually, it's true. You had a brief period of non-warmongering. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I shook it off. it's still the place to be. We all walk around in our medieval armor and all that, so it's very exciting. So.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I hope to
I'll have you over for lunch sometime. Yeah.
That's right. I'll order vegan.
Excellent.
See how it goes over. So I think we were going to start out by talking about the surprise announcement by Evan Bayh that he's not going to run for re-election. Usually when members of Congress say that they're not going to run for re-election, they either say it's to be with their family or they say it's because the system doesn't work, or both. They never say, like, you know, I just couldn't get those fat cat jerks to give me enough money again to buy my seat. Anyway, Bayh said that the system is broken, which is what people have been saying for a long time. But I actually have a piece coming out, which will be out when this airs, presumably in cover story in Time, arguing that I think Bayh is right. The country, as you and I have often mentioned, the country at large, people out there in the country aren't really that polarized. But in Washington, the difficulty of getting big things done, I think, is greater than it was before. And I think a lot of that has to do with the just explosion of the use of the filibuster. I mean, the filibuster is being used by the Republicans just way, way more than it's ever been used in American history. And when you create a 60-vote requirement to get things through the Senate, you really can gum up the works a lot, and that's part of what Bayh is responding to.
Okay, well, I mean, first of all, we should clarify that Bayh may be correct, right, in his diagnosis of American democracy. I don't think he is, but that's one issue. And then the other issue is whether or not his stated diagnosis of American democracy is in fact the reason why he's not running, which is a separate issue, right?
Yes, I mean, two separate issues.
Jim Jeffords had some absolutely idiotic explanation for why he was switching parties having to do with education funding under the Bush administration. Now, that argument might have been true or it might not have been true, but it wasn't why he switched. And the same thing with Bayh. I mean, Bayh all of a sudden had a serious challenger in Dan Coats in a tough year for Democrats. And Bayh had accumulated a record of, let's put it this way, that was more liberal than his reputation as a moderate. That was going to be a real problem for him seeking re-election. Now, it may be true that he's fed up with Washington. The reports from people who know him seem to indicate that that's sincere, that he's fed up with the system and all the rest. But certainly it's plausible that one of the things that entered into his mind is that he hated the job and he hated the prospect of having a tough and bruising re-election fight to get a job that he didn't like.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I'm sure that in most of these cases, both of those things play into them. The question is, do you love the job enough to have to go through a year of hell to try to keep it? I mean, I think Bayh probably still would have been the favorite, but you're right. This is going to be a tough year anywhere, and probably particularly in Indiana. It's also that probably the things that you hate the most about being in the Senate, which is probably the fundraising for most people, is the kind of thing that you're going to be having to do, more overwhelmingly in that particular year than even in off years. So I think you're right. The two things kind of come together.
Right. He did have I think the fundraising thing can be overstated because he had a $13 million war chest.
Yeah, yeah.
I think also he's interested in, I think foolishly, but it seems to me he's interested in running for president someday, and being defeated would ruin that. Bowing out in disgust at the Democratic Party to burnish his moderate credentials, which are much more damaged than a lot of the press coverage would indicate. The guy voted against both of Bush's judges, both Supreme Court judges. He voted against confirmation of Condi Rice. He made all sots of really partisan speeches to curry favor to get the vice presidential nomination. You know, the guy danced for the Democratic Party quite a bit and kept getting screwed. And I think that's part of his frustration. And so bowing out now kind of says F you to the Democratic Party and leaves the possibility of running as sort of a new Democrat DLC type in the future.
I'm sure you're right that Evan Bayh, as he was thinking about running for president, moved a little bit to the left. But I think, you know, before we should also remember that noted conservative Democrat Barack Obama did manage to win Indiana in 2008. Now, it's 2010, of course, is going to be a bad year for Democrats. But I think we should remember that it's actually it's not impossible for a Democratic senator who leans a little bit more left to have a chance in Indiana. Time.
Not this year, though.
This year it's going to be horrific, even if you live in Greenwich Village. But I think I would have interpreted it differently just on the Bayh thing, that actually what Bayh realized in 2008 was that he was probably too conservative to ever win the Democratic nomination, and that that's part of the reason that he's basically bowing out of politics. He was considered three times for the vice presidential position and never got it. But your interpretation is also, I suppose, plausible.
I think
a DLC Democrat is going to have that much chance of winning the primary, you know, in the years to come.
No, I agree, and that would be a good blogging heads topic about, first of all, whether Obama would have a primary challenge and other things. Anyway, moving on to the gitchy goo, thumb suckery question about the filibuster. I think, to an overwhelming degree, this is all a bunch of nonsense, and so much of it is wildly hypocritical, partisan and ideological will to power stuff masquerading as Norm Ornstein good government stuff. You say that the Republicans are using the filibuster wildly more than ever. In pure numbers, my understanding is they are using it more than ever. But, a lot of the filibuster stuff they're using it for, Shelby's hold on, nominations or whatever, that got broken because that was an unpopular thing to do. The filibuster on health care, you hear all of these people, all these, American Prospect, Center for American Progress types, gnashing their teeth and rending their clothes over the idea that it's so undemocratic that there's a filibuster. And the problem with that is, among other things, is that, first of all, the Senate's not supposed to be as democratic as the House. This is a point that Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer and all of these guys waxed poetic about, from 2005 to 2008. How many times did you do a Nexus search? How many times did Chuck Schumer talk about how the Senate was intended by the founding fathers to be the cooling saucer, to slow things down? You had all of the hard left wing activist groups who opposed all of Bush's judicial picks, saying how important it was to be obstructionist and to slow things down, and the filibuster was this bulwark against tyranny and whatnot. And now all of a sudden, all of those arguments go out the window, and the filibuster is this grand and horrific roadblock to all good things. And I find it incredibly unpersuasive, particularly on this anti-democratic point, not just because the Senate is not supposed to be all that democratic, but secondly, because the position that the filibusterers are taking is the majority position of the American people right now. These guys, the Republicans have the polls on their side on this stuff. And yet you hear the Democrats saying that democracy is being thwarted. It seems to me that politicians listening to the will of the people against a majority that is not on the side of the American people There are lots of things you can say against that, but bleeding and whining about how it's undemocratic is really unpersuasive to me.
No, General. Well, look, Barack Obama won the presidential election running on health care. He had 59 Democrats. At least 55 of them clearly wanted to pass health care all last year. And even, you're right, the polls have soured on this, partly because of how ugly the process was because of the filibuster. But for a good part of, for much of last year, first of all, I don't think, you don't judge democracy by where the polls are at that moment. You had a president who ran on health care who won 59 Democratic senators, and most of those Democratic senators, 55 of whom, basically, in support of health care. You're wrong about the United States Senate. It's not supposed to be the House, but it's not supposed to be a place where you need 60 votes to get anything done. The filibuster was used once per decade in the 19th century, and even as recently as the 1960s, it was used about 10% of all major legislation. The Republicans are using it 80% of the time, Jonah. That's far more than the Democrats did. Let's go back to this story about the use on judges, right? What happened? The Democrats said they were going to use it on judges. They ended up backing off because a group of moderates said that it would only be used in extraordinary circumstances. And then most of the judges went through. Well, using it 80% of the time does not seem to be extraordinary circumstances. Even Olympia Snowe said it should only be used in extraordinary circumstances, and now she's filibustering a bill that she actually voted for in Senate Finance Committee. I mean, of course there are partisan motivations here, but there are also the facts. And the facts are that the filibuster is being used in a way that would have absolutely horrified people for most of American history. In fact, a group of Republican moderates came out in the 1990s, and they themselves said that the use of the filibuster by the Gingrich Congress was appalling and completely... Now, there were other ways that the system was gummed up in different ways in earlier parts of American history. But the idea that the Senate was designed so you needed 60 votes to pass most legislation is just not true.
I didn't say the Senate was designed to use 60 votes, or 67, which it was for a long time, right?
When it was 67, the filibuster was used extremely rarely because it was a real filibuster. You had to stay on the floor all night.
Well, let's go through it. I mean, I have no problem going back to the old-fashioned filibuster. I mean, and I agree with you that it's used too much by Republicans as it was used or threatened to be used, which is sort of the same thing in politics, mm-hmm. too much by Democrats. But, you know, you can throw up how it's being used 80% of the time by Republicans, whatever that means. And all that is masking the fact that you don't like the fact that it's being basically used one time, which is in regard to health care.
No, it's not only that. I don't like the fact that they needed 60 votes to get past the deficit commission. I don't like the fact they'll need 60 votes to do financial reform. I mean, they needed 60 votes on the stimulus.
Let's fine. So you don't like it on all sorts of parts of the Democratic agenda. Fair enough. You cite the 19th century. Well, in the 19th century, senators were not even directly elected, right? So this idea that somehow the filibuster, the use of the filibuster in the 19th century was more enlightened, obscures the fact that for all these people who are screaming about how the filibuster today is undemocratic and they cite the 19th century, they're overlooking the fact that the Senate was a Republican, small r, Republican institution and was conceived of being as a Republican institution. So, you know, there's a real apples and oranges problem here. It was not a democratic, small d, democratic institution. It was intended to be less democratic and to slow things down and to take the bigger picture in mind. And because of direct election of senators, you have things like the rise of the filibuster, so the Senate can still slow things down. That doesn't bother me in the slightest.
No, but I think you're conflating different things, Jonah. I mean, the fact that the senators were not elected directly was not about slowing things down. I mean, I agree it was anti-democratic. But the way the filibuster, you could have things go through very quickly, even though the senators were appointed by the state legislature. So I think it's an apples and oranges point.
Well, look, I'm addressing the argument that people like, they do this 3 or 4 part argument where they say the filibuster today is undemocratic, and then they start quoting the Senate from the 19th century and its lack of the use of the filibuster as proof that it's undemocratic. But what they've omit from the discussion is the fact that the Senate was vastly less democratic at the time, and it's sort of a problem.
Black people couldn't vote too. But I mean, but the point I'm addressing is the idea that the people who created the United States Senate had the idea that you should not be able to get things done with 51 votes. And I think that's not the case, actually. I mean, that's why there are serious people who think that the filibuster may even potentially be unconstitutional, because you can read the Constitution as pretty clearly saying that, in fact, that the vice president breaks a tie, and he breaks a tie of, which is when you have an equivalent vote, not that you need 60 or 67 or whatever above the 51.
I love it when liberals return to original intent.
liberals read the Constitution just like conservatives do.
The Senate, I think it is ludicrous to claim that somehow the Senate has, up until the day before yesterday, essentially, had rules that were, you know, the cooling saucer thing comes from George Washington. That was the intent of the thing from the beginning. The rules have always been set up where one guy can bollocks up the whole thing, right?
Well,
it has always been this debating society modeled on the House of Lords that was supposed to take a longer view. And regardless of these, you know, Robert's Rules of Order arguments about the role of the filibuster, it seems to me that, you know, for the last 40 years, or at least since the early 1990s, the argument has always been made that you can't do sweeping, transformative legislation on a party line basis. That was Daniel Patrick Moynihan talking about that, hardly an enemy of good government. That has been the sort of the conventional wisdom at every sort of thumbsucky Brookings Institution, AEI, kind of discussion about these sorts of issues, from welfare reform and NAFTA on down. That was the whole point of the Clinton era. And when you say that all of a sudden, you know, this is exactly what, you know, good government is about, is allowing a bunch of Democrats to have their way, just doesn't strike me as all that persuasive. And when you say that Obama ran on health care, we have these arguments about what people's mandates were. A lot of you guys, including you, really disputed the idea that Bush's mandate was to privatize Social Security after 2004. He put it out before the American people, and lo and behold, the American people said, hey, that actually wasn't your mandate. The same, but, you know, Barack Obama's mandate was to be not George Bush. He fulfilled that mandate.
I disagree. I think Barack Obama talked much, much, much more about health care in 2008 than George W. Bush talked about privatization.
And people didn't listen to it. People didn't care about it.
Yeah,
voters cared about it, but the idea that somehow the 2008 election hinged on health care, I just don't think works. And when you say these 55 senators are in there and they all want health care reform and it's all democracy and Obama won in 2008, most of those 55 senators weren't elected in 2008. Those guys didn't have mandates.
That's silly. I mean, they still have the right to vote in the U.S. Senate even if they were elected in 2006 or 2004.
Sure, but you're invoking this mandate and this stuff about, you know, thwarting democracy by setting these 55 senators, when really it's something like a dozen senators were elected in 2008. I don't know if any of them can be. How many of them
can be
on health care?
Okay, fine. The Senate elects a third every 2 years. I don't really know what the point of that is. The point is that you had, when Barack Obama was elected, a president who had been on health care, and a pretty large Senate majority that basically wanted to do something, you know, that they wanted to do, you know, the details were, you could discuss the details, but basically wanted to insure more people and force insurance companies to cover pre-existing conditions and that kind of thing. It didn't happen. I mean, your point about, I think you've two points that I want to address. First of all, yes, it's true that historically the Senate has been gummed up in various different ways. That, you know, committee chairmen had more power to keep things from getting out of committee, for instance. But the situation you have now, which is where you have a stealth filibuster, where you don't actually have to do a filibuster, I think really is really unprecedented. If Republicans could actually get it together to actually pay the price to do a real filibuster, which I don't think they could do, I would find this less appalling than the idea that they can basically just raise their hand and say, I'm filibustering, and that's it. And you know, on this point that you have to have bipartisan majorities to get things done, I mean, you know, yes and no. When you look at, you know, Reagan's tax cuts or Bush's tax cuts, these were basically overwhelmingly Republican things that had maybe a couple of votes, and in often cases with the Bush agenda, they passed through reconciliation because they didn't need 60 votes. So I think that it's a little bit of, and you know, if you look at Medicare and Social Security, in essence, those were really pretty party line votes. So I don't think it's entirely the case that there's something illegitimate about the idea of if you have 59 or 60 votes in the Senate, basically getting something done. It certainly wasn't considered illegitimate when George W. Bush passed through the prescription drug plan on a party line vote, for instance.
Oh, there's a lot of screaming about how that vote came to be. There was enormous controversy about keeping that vote open and the tactics of running a party line way on that. I mean, that was a huge.
That's right, but not mostly from Republicans.
Yeah, that's fine, Peter. But you know, this is one of the great dangers of these sort of blogging heads kinds of conversations is that your side is hypocritical for taking the Republican side, and my side is hypocritical for taking the Democratic side on these procedural issues, because the people in power all of a sudden want the procedure to work in their favor, and the people out of power all of a sudden adopt the tactics of the people who are out of power before them. And
yes, but you're right. As a general point, of course you're right. But the danger in that is always to assume there's absolute equivalence. And the fact is, Republicans are filibustering a lot more than Democrats did. As a general point about motivations, of course, nobody is pure here. In general, more people care more about outcomes than procedures. But it can still be the case that the procedural abuses are worse in one case than they are in another. And I think they are worse here.
I'm entirely open to that, and I agree with you. I think the filibuster should be a more serious filibuster. There should be less of them. I think a lot of the Democratic ones are frivolous, and I think a lot of the Republican ones are frivolous. But I think some of them aren't frivolous, and that and the big ones that I would support would be the ones like on health care. And it seems to me that everyone wants to sort of say, well, you know, democracy has spoken. Democracy is constantly speaking again. And if Republican tactics are as egregious as all you guys are saying they are, and if the the arguments and the facts are so aligned as you claim, then presumably Republicans would be held accountable for their obstructionism in the next election. But it doesn't look like that's going to happen. I mean, there's an ongoing job performance evaluation going on, and as it stands right now, the Democrats with 59 senators, or up until a moment ago, 60 senators, and controlling the White House and the House, they've gotten very poor reviews by voters.
Two things. First of all, I think the Republicans might pay a little bit more of a price if they actually had to, if their obstructionism was actually, if they were actually forced to be obstructionists in the old-fashioned way. I mean, and I'm glad you agree with me on this. You know, if Republican senators hate the idea of health care reform, I mean, you know, this horrific ultra-left-wing Obama health care bill that has so much in common with the Republican alternative to what Clinton offered in 1993, that they actually want to stay up all night reading from Grandma's recipe book to oppose it, I would find that a little bit less appalling. But I think that I would find that, you know, I'd say, okay, at least these guys are willing to put themselves on the line for this. But I think actually it would look worse to the American people. I think if you look at the Republican Party, it's not like the Republican Party's approval rating has improved. The Republican Party is actually less popular in Congress than the Democratic Party. It's just that basically when people become very, very hostile to government, A, because the economy really sucks, and B, because they don't believe that government is getting anything done, they punish the people in power. And that's in some ways the brilliance of the Republican strategy is if you want to throw the bums out, the Democrats are the bums. So the Republicans don't actually benefit, don't actually get hurt by gumming up the works, because Americans basically just turn on whoever is running things.
Yeah, I think there's obviously some truth to that. But at the same time, this idea that somehow the Republican Party doesn't own its policy of obstructionism just seems silly to me. I mean, the Republican Party is branded every single day by the Democratic Party, by much of the mainstream press, by the President of the United States, as the party of no, as the party of standing athwart Obama's domestic agenda. Anybody who follows politics knows that the Republicans are filibustering all of this stuff. And yet, a Republican gets elected in Massachusetts for Ted Kennedy's seat. Republicans get elected in New Jersey. Republicans get elected in Virginia. Evan Bayh is dropping out. This idea that it's purely anti-incumbent and completely unconnected with the agenda of the Democratic Party and the stimulus and the healthcare push and terror trials and all of the rest, I think that is sort of a bunker mentality on the part of a lot of liberals.
Well, but I mean, you know, if you actually poll people on the individual components of the Obama health care bill, they say they like them. You know, I mean, so I'm not necessarily – now, I think on some of the terror trial stuff, You're right. I mean, on some of the terror trial stuff, Obama pulled the Democratic position, or what used to be the Democratic position until the Democrats fled from it, is very unpopular. I mean, I think you can get the American people don't like the idea of civilian trials terribly much, and although I think they're wrong. So I think there are on some of that stuff. You're right, but I'm not willing actually to. And I think it's also we have to remember that the American people don't really understand very much. I mean, they don't really know what's in the healthcare bill, according to polling, nor do I think most of them really actually know what a filibuster is. You know, and that sounds horribly elitist and elitist, but in fact, that's what actually the polling suggests. So I think one has to remember that there's an enormous amount of fog here that leads to why people have this incredibly negative perception. You know, not to mention the elephant in the room, which is that when you're in enormous economic distress, as a lot of the country is, you're basically likely to be hostile to whoever is in power.
Yeah, look, we should move on to the terror trial stuff, but let me just sort of, you can respond, but my last word is I certainly hope that the Democratic Party acts on your basic assumptions here and blames all of their problems on the system, the voters, and the economy, and does not for a moment countenance the idea that maybe they are the authors of their own problems in any way. I think that is what we're seeing to a great degree from the Democratic leadership, what we've seen from the House, what we saw in response to the Scott Brown victory, and I think it is a recipe for absolute destruction in 2010 and maybe even 2012.
Well, I guess my view would be I think that the Democrats are pretty much cooked in 2010. I mean, individual races will go one way or the other. I mean, I think they're basically – I think that they're going to be – are they going to be in worse shape if they pass health care reform than if they don't? I'm not actually convinced of that at all. I think they'll be in pretty bad shape either way. I think actually in 2012, you know, it all has to do with whether the economy comes back or not. But we'll still be doing blogging heads at that point. So let's talk about the terror trial stuff.
Okay.
I guess, you know, I think, you know, you were saying – I think you're right. The Republicans are making hay about this. It's a little weird because Obama's numbers – on the question of terrorism actually are not bad and have not dropped since the Christmas Day bombing. But I think on the individual debates, moving the Gitmo people onto American territory or doing the KSM trial in New York, I think there's no question that the public opinion is clearly with Republicans. And you can see a lot of Democrats kind of fleeing the position that Obama or at least Eric Holder wanted to flee. So I think on the politics, I think the conservative side basically has the wind at its back. I guess where I but you know one of the things you and I always like to try to do is separate politics and policy. So let me just make a point about the policy here. I don't really get it. I mean, the Republican Party has been kind of blowing, you know, a gasket over Obama's treatment of the Christmas Day bomber. As far as I can see, it's been an enormous success. I mean, the guy was kind of treated in a lawful way, and he's been talking and giving us great intelligence. So this has become the kind of the thing that Elizabeth Cheney and everybody else is so exercised about. On the KSM trial as well, do you guys really believe that the terrorists are going to be more likely to try to blow up in New York if he's tried there than if he wasn't? I just don't understand what the substantive grounds actually. I understand it's good politics, but I don't really understand what the substantive grounds for attacking Obama stuff on this stuff are.
Well, I mean, it seems to me, I don't know. I mean, there are lots of ways to respond to this. First of all, I think that much of the debate about the Christmas bomber is, you know, the movie starts earlier than that. You know, it starts with the Hassan shooting to a certain extent. Or maybe it starts with, you know, a lot of the Holder decisions about trying the 8 CIA interrogators and all the rest. So there's the policy backdrop, which is that conservatives, for the most part, disagree with this idea, and I know you have different views about this, but disagree with the idea that terrorists should be treated like conventional criminals. But I want
to stop and I want to ask you about that. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. That's what it always comes down to. But my question is, that seems to me this kind of almost kind of you know, catechism on the right here. I mean, when it turns out that actually treating Abdul-Muttalib like a conventional, like a common criminal or whatever the poll-tested phrase is, actually turned out to be an extremely good way to treat him, that makes no difference. Because it's as if what really matters, the way I hear it, what really matters for conservatives is if you call it a war, it means you believe the other guys are really, 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 really evil. But if you don't, then it means you think they're only maybe a little bit evil. And that's really what matters. It's as if the consequences of how effective these different tactics are seem to somehow not come into it.
Well, first of all, you know, I just – neither of us knows the answer to this, I would answer. But I want to put a pin in this idea that we know what we're getting from Abdul-Muttalib. I mean, we know what the White House is saying we're getting from Abdul-Muttalib. We know there are leaks saying that these interrogations have yielded all sorts of great stuff. But the story from the White House about when he was interrogated, when he was Mirandized, when he started talking – what he said and all the rest has been all over the place. Gibbs' performance on this has been real amateur hour stuff. And
Well, just for the record, I know this is bizarre because it actually involves reporting, but I was actually told by a career person who works on these issues in the government that the intelligence that Muttalib has given has been fabulous and extremely helpful in all kinds of ways.
Great if true. I mean, that's great if true, and you know, if the source is correct, that's great too, and that's wonderful. But it doesn't necessarily change the policy argument very much, because it still gets back down to this argument about whether or not you're going to treat these guys. If you want to hinge whether that's smart policy or not about what you get out of Muttalib, well, then, you know, you can say that Napolitano was right when she said the system worked because the guy didn't blow up a plane. I mean, the plural of anecdote isn't necessarily data on this. And the philosophical disagreement, as I think we both agree, is that conservatives don't think that you should be treating these guys as criminals. You should be treating them as enemy combatants.
But why?
Well, I think there are a bunch of different reasons. I don't think it's purely because they're evil and we should treat them like they're evil, but that it's because it's bad public policy. I mean, I personally think Martisan makes a good point about this stuff, is that, you know, interrogation, not necessarily waterboarding, but, you know, waterboarding is the last step, apparently, on all this kind of stuff, and now it's even illegal. But interrogation is incredibly important. And the idea of Mirandizing these guys before you can get intelligence as a policy is sort of loopy. Now, it worked because Abdul-Muttalib is a certain kind of person, or because they brought in his family, or because his crotch caught on fire. I don't know. But the idea that you're going to then institutionalize this policy is the one best way in all cases because of Abdul-Muttalib sounds sort of crazy to me. And
I don't – I mean, it seems to me you're right. This is only one – anecdote. I mean, it's an important case, but it's only one. So, I mean, if people have other examples in which this process of treating them through the legal system was a terrible failure and got us nothing, and the enemy combatant way was much better. But again, I mean, I ended up doing a little bit of reading about this over the weekend. I mean, as far as I can tell, you know, with Padilla, they got very, very little, and then when they basically threw him into this legal black hole situation, with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who they waterboarded 183 times. Three times. The guy said a lot of stuff, but a lot of it was lies. So, I mean, these are only anecdotal cases. By the nature of this stuff, a lot of the reality is clouded because it's top secret. But I'm waiting for Republicans to start showing me the cases in which their way, the Cheney way, has worked better. I mean, it seems to me you have to counter the anecdote with something.
Well, I don't know. The stuff that we allegedly heard from KSM, I mean, I've heard, you know, and I've read in the New York Times and elsewhere that he started to hold a seminar on the structure of al-Qaeda and gave all sorts of information. The other guys who were waterboarded did as well. It's interesting. This is sort of a tangent, but I actually did some reporting about something related to this yesterday because I was on a special report and we had to argue about the new rules of engagement in Afghanistan. And I talked to this former special forces guy about this, who supports the rules of engagement being very strict over there. And one of the points he made was that, you know, if you don't have good intelligence gathering, if you don't have good interrogation, good intelligence gathering, all that kind of stuff, then it's very hard to have a restrictive rule of engagement in the theater of combat, because it's intelligence that allows you to be surgical. It's intelligence that allows you to pick out, you know, the one guy instead of killing the 500 people around the guy with a bomb. And his take, is that the administration is still sort of schizophrenic about how it wants to do this stuff, and by treating the war on terrorism stuff as a law enforcement thing and Mirandizing these guys and all of the rest, it does curtail the ability to do intelligence gathering, at least according to the professionals that I talked to. I'm sure you can find professionals that you didn't that disagree. But you know, getting back to the Hassan point, I mean, there's you know, Obama's initial reaction out of the gate was that the Fort Hood shooter was this isolated extremist, this lone gunman who's just angry at the world, and that we shouldn't assume anything. And that turned out to be an absolute. It wasn't simply wrong, and it wasn't simply revealing, I think, of Obama's ideological mindset about the war on terror, or about his political instincts, which says that he'll benefit if he downplays the war on terror and tries to make it sort of not such a hot issue in American politics, which I think he really does believe is both good for the country and good for him. But it was also sort of scandalously untrue, as we then found out that Alokwe had been corresponding with this guy. There was all sorts of intelligence, you know, saying that Hassan is somebody to worry about. There are red flags all over the place. Then you have the Christmas bomber, and you have almost the exact same reaction, this clueless response from Napolitano, this argument from Gibbs that that they got everything they needed from him in the first 50 minutes. You know, my sense is that they took so much heat from this that they then started saying, we got to get more from Abdulmutallab, you know, from this guy. And I'm glad that they did. But it seems to me that there is a larger framework of the way this administration has been responding to things that has been not entirely edifying. And I think, getting back to the politics for 2 seconds, you know, the Scott Brown thing, you know, that was a huge issue for Scott Brown in Massachusetts, the idea that we're going to give lawyers to terrorists really strikes a chord with the American people. And I think that, you know, you want to put it in this sort of, well, Republicans think terrorists are more evil than Democrats think they're evil, and it's this Manichaean, cynical, you know, kind of thing. I think there is a sort of right and wrong notion about some of this that appeals to the American, you know, sense of right and wrong. And I think that should tell us something about how we frame these policies.
Well, I mean, you know, I don't want to just get back and, you know, get into RNC, DNC talking points here, but it is, as many Democrats have pointed out, it is the truth, in fact, that in most of these cases, the Bush administration also gave these guys lawyers. I mean, they Mirandized Richard Reid in 5 minutes. So, but I actually think that is telling, in the sense that it suggests that amongst the kind of people who do, the career people who do this for a living, there, you know, in the FBI and elsewhere, there is a general view that actually there's a lot of value to doing that kind of thing. I mean, by basically treating people in accordance with the law, rather than putting them into this kind of legal netherworld situation. One of the reasons, if you don't do that, if you waterboard them, or if you don't basically give them some kind of, you know, give them a lawyer and give them some kind of rights, first of all, I think you're very unlikely to get the family to help you as you did with Abdulmutallab, which I think was probably really important in getting his cooperation. Secondly, why is the family cooperating? Because they know that if they get him to spill his guts about this, then the government may cut him a slightly better deal. I mean, what that's going to mean in this case, who knows? You know, maybe a few more bathroom breaks or something like that in his lifetime in prison. But still, there's an incentive that our system is set up, for very, very bad guys. I mean, people say, it's kind of funny to me when I hear Republicans say common criminals, as if, oh, common criminals aren't really that bad. Actually, these are the very people who Republicans have been kind of, you know, running on their evil for many, many years, and yet we still, many of these people have hearts of ice-cold evil, and yet we have a system which works because it gives them certain incentives to play ball. And I think those incentives are really important. So it seems to me that it's just not random that things worked out well with Abdulmutallab, or the fact that the Bush administration needed a win. I think the reason this was even done mostly in the Bush administration over Cheney's objections is that it's actually the best method that we have.
So that strikes me as sort of utterly without evidence as well. I mean, you can hinge it all on Abdulmutallab, but there aren't going to be that many terrorists we're going to get that we know how to reach their rich Nigerian parents to come in and make nice. And there's nothing precluding giving good deals to people in the enemy combatant system under the judicial trial system. We could get into the talking point thing again, but we gave a lot of these guys lawyers under Bush for habeas corpus trial, you know, hearings, not as for criminal procedures.
Well, from Moussaoui, I mean, you had a lawyer from Moussaoui, and you had a lawyer, I mean, and Richard
Rigo was the biggest one. We spent 5 years debating what a national policy was going to be. We had two Supreme Court cases settling this stuff, lots of legislation, lots of hearings, and we worked through to the other side. And some of these things that happened under Bush were before that process ensued. And so, you know, we're talking about how Reed was Mirandized in December of 2001 or whatever it was, overlooks the fact that we didn't have that system in place. And it's just, to me, you know, we didn't Mirandize John Wilkes Booth or something. I mean, it's something that happened earlier in the space-time continuum.
Well, I don't really understand. I hear people keep on making this argument that somehow because it happened in December 2001, therefore, I mean, why? If the idea was so terrible, why didn't on the fly the people in the Bush administration just decide, you know what, he's a terrorist, he's not a common criminal, we're not going to Mirandize him? I mean, they did that. Well, they did do that with Jose Padilla and that guy Almari, so it's not as if they didn't do it with anybody.
Well, my only point is that the system, you know, again, this is sort of making data out of anecdotes. I mean, there are different circumstances for all of these things. These things happened before the system had worked out. You know, my wife worked for Ashcroft at the Justice Department during this time. All of those guys were desperate to get to get as many terrorists in court as they wanted, because these were career prosecutor types who believed that this is what they were put on this earth to do. But, you know, the last point I sort of want to object to is, you know, you keep trying to turn it around to how Republicans view the ontological status of terrorists versus, you know, that we think they're more we really think they're evil and you guys don't. I mean, you want to get it back to the sort of root causes kind of argument. And, you know, that we've been demonizing conventional criminals and running on that for years and years and years. I don't know. Maybe there's some truth in there. I mean, I'm sure, you know, all of these things are true about some people and not true about other people. But to me, it sounds like it does a disservice to the larger argument, which is that, yeah, Hannibal Lecter is an evil guy, and and Ted Bundy or whatever that guy, you know, these are evil people, and rapists are evil and all of the rest. But they are typically not members of non-state international terrorist conspiratorial organizations dedicated to the destruction of the United States of America and the mass murder of lots of Americans. They are much, you know, they may be non-state, but and they may have organizational structures like the Cosa Nostra or something, but their intention is much closer to that of a country we are at war with. And we don't have criminal trials for soldiers from enemy countries. And even under the Geneva Conventions, which everyone is sort of reified into the be-all and end-all of things, it seems to me just as a moral and a logical issue, outrageous to claim that terrorists who by definition don't adhere to the Geneva Conventions deserve greater protections than they would have if they did subscribe to the Geneva Conventions. It just, you know, there has to be some sort of carrot and stick understanding about how the Geneva Conventions are going to work. And if you're going to ignore all of the rules of law, do things that are considered repugnant and criminal and beneath contempt according to the international law regime, and then say, well, we have to treat these guys as if they are adherents and signatories to the Geneva Conventions, just strikes me as sort of a non-starter.
Well, first of all, let me just say, I mean, the point I was making about this question of evil was not to suggest, I should make it clear for myself or other liberals, that I don't think that someone who tries to kill lots of innocent civilians is evil. I think that's an evil act.
Yeah, no, I know but, you do. I, mean, I wasn't my, suggesting my, otherwise.
Yeah, no, I probably was not clear about this. It has to do with whether that's the important question in trying to figure out what to do about them. I guess, you know, the problem I have with what you're saying is, and I find a lot of this in this debate, is how do we know when you say this person's a terrorist, you're assuming that they're guilty. Now, obviously, in the Abdul Muttalib case, it's pretty obvious, right?
Right.
But in lots of these cases, for instance, at Guantanamo Bay, the circumstances are very cloudy. I mean, we rounded up a lot of people on the battlefield in Afghanistan in various circumstances or another. And so the whole point is that you need some kind of due process in order to figure out whether, in fact, they are terrorists or not. And when one simply assumes that they are and moves from there, in some ways you put the carrot before the horse. And one of the reasons that having a system that's considered kind of that's considered kosher by other countries is so useful in this regard, in fact, is that those other countries are willing to share their intelligence, which makes it easier, in fact, to get to the bottom of whether these guys are guilty or not. And I think that was one of the big flaws with the Bush military tribunals they set up, because other countries were not willing to basically participate. And whereas with Abdulmutallab, we are actually likely to get very likely to be able to prosecute him, not only because he's obviously guilty, but because when we do it this way, we basically have other countries willing to participate in our legal system and give us evidence, which puts us in a stronger position.
Yeah, no, I don't agree with it entirely, but I think it's entirely reasonable. I do agree entirely that we need a system to adjudicate the status of people, that obviously there are going to be mistakes. I don't think, at least my understanding is that you could have said that about some of the people who were in Gitmo a while ago, but the people who are left are pretty clearly bad dudes.
It's probably true that, in fact, even some of the people, I mean, this is the irony of the debate. I mean, some of the people we let out were bad dudes because there has been some recidivism, right? I mean, people the Bush administration left out. So, I'm not claiming that everyone who was at Gitmo or even the bulk of people at Gitmo were good guys. I'm just saying that it was hard to tell in some cases.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And I agree entirely that we need a system to adjudicate these sorts of things. You know, it's funny. This has been one of the deep ironies of this stuff from day one. I remember Bill Sapphire wrote some really confused columns about this when he was still writing for the Times. You know, there's sort of the upshot of some of this is that it's better to indiscriminately kill people in Afghanistan than to take custody of live people. Because then they're in this limbo, and it creates all this controversy and all of the rest. And do you Mirandize, Osama bin Laden if you find him, or can you just kill him and all the rest? Mm-hmm. But look, I agree that there needs to be a system, and I think it's if the system that we were setting up in terms of military commissions were really turning off all of our European allies and all of the rest. Well, you know, I'm conflicted about that because some of it I think was really shameless political posturing by European allies, but at the same time, you do need allies when you're fighting this kind of thing. And if the military commission system that Congress set up, with a strong buy-in from the Democratic Party, if that commission system wasn't the right way to do it, then let's revisit the commission system. But to say that we need a way to adjudicate the status of these guys and make sure that they're terrorists. Is to me not the same thing as saying that we should be trying them in downtown Manhattan, giving them the same legal protections that we give to American citizens. It seems to me it's a non sequitur.
I think that actually the record from the Bush administration is that the civilian system has worked better than the military tribunals. But I think as a political matter, you're right that basically I think the military tribunals in some adapted form is probably where we're going because that's what you can get. Some Republican support for, and the public is more supportive of that as well. So I think, whatever Eric Holder wants in his heart, I think that's probably where we're going with this anyway. We were going to talk about China, but it actually occurred to me I want to see whether I can get you to talk about Sarah Palin. I have a particular – I know she's a terrible topic. No one ever likes talking about Sarah Palin. But I had a particular thought about Sarah Palin that I wanted to run by you.
Okay.
Well, I guess what it came out of is on ABC on this week on Sunday, they asked Dick Cheney if she was qualified. And he basically threw her under the bus, which I think he did once before. In fact, I think maybe it was in Game Change, it was reported that Cheney said that McCain had made a reckless choice when he chose. Cheney has some record evidently be kind of anti-Palin. And this was he was kind of anti-Palin on Sunday because he wouldn't say she was qualified. It kind of confirmed my general sense of the way it looks to me that is if Palin's relationship with the Republican Party is emerging, which is to say she has a big grassroots following, but it seems to me she has very, very little elite support, either from Republican politician types or from Republican big money types. And it just seems to me this is partly informed by a good piece that I read on Politico about this. But so my theory, there's been this kind of wave of people like David Broder and Joe Klein saying she's the front runner for 2012 for the Republicans. But it seems to me, again, as an outsider to the anthropology of the Republican Party has a history of nominating you know, the guy who came in second last time. It's more hierarchical, mm-hmm. the Democratic Party. And that the Republican Party establishment, for a variety of reasons, seems the intellectuals, the money people, the political people seem to be lining up pretty strongly in opposition to her. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know that they're lining up in opposition to her, but I mean, I think you were right in that she is less popular with the Republican establishment, the Republican elite, and all of that, than she is with certainly the Tea Party crowd, obviously, mm-hmm. but also the let's call it, you know, a sizable chunk of the base of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything objectionable to that analysis. I think that's one of the reasons why she's popular. I mean, it's important to remember the antipathy among a lot of the Tea Party people for the Republican mm-hmm. establishment is really strong. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite signs at I went to the Tea Party thing on the Mall. Mm-hmm. I was on the periphery of it. And one of my favorite signs was this guy, big guy with Timberland boots and shorts and a T-shirt that was straining the laws of gravity. And he had a giant handmade sign and it just said, "Impeach everybody." Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you listen to the actual speeches in the Tea Party crowd, those guys, they dislike what the Democrats are doing more, but there's a lot of this is buyer's remorse and built up anti-Bush sentiment.
Because Bush spent too much money.
Yeah, I mean, and the Republican Congress sentiment and all of the rest in that, that was one of the things that McCain suffered from. People didn't really realize how much McCain was being blamed as sort of Bushism, you know, as sort of Bush 2.0.
You don't find Tea Party people who have buyer's remorse about Bush foreign policy. Because, I mean, what I think is interesting is that Army does. I mean, Army has come out and said that he never wanted to vote for the Iraq War and that he feels bad that he did and that he was basically lied into it. I mean, it's basically what he said. But you don't find that. Do you find that amongst – I'm trying to figure out how much Ron Paulism there is among the Tea Party crowd.
That's hard to say. I mean, I've done no, you know, reporting other than, you know, the people I happen to –
These are your people, Jonah.
I know, and I get a lot of email from these people. I mean, I know a lot of these people, but you know, I've never been confused for a rabid Ron Paul guy, but it's all the Federal Reserve. I think that's right. I mean, I think that, you know, she's considered sort of an outsider. I think she is vastly more popular in the conservative movement than she is in the Republican Party, if that makes sense. And I also think that, you know, in some ways, I think that she suffers from the fact, or I think it's sort of unfair the way she's been turned into, you know, an icon or an abstraction, where she sort of represents something other than the actual person for both her fans and her enemies. Mm-hmm. She's neither the ogre nor the messiah that either side claims she is, and. But for a certain chunk of the right, and I'm part of that chunk. The one thing I think a lot of people can agree with is you have to love Sarah Palin for her enemies. What she brings out in, Dick Cheney might have given her a slap in sort of inside the Beltway lingo, but you know he wasn't brimming with bile and he wasn't personal or ad hominem or anything like that. And meanwhile, the stuff that comes out of liberals about Sarah Palin is so unhinged and so so unbelievably nasty that it does cause a certain rally around Palin effect for people
don't
necessarily want her to be president, but, you know, she doesn't have to be president.
That seems to me in some ways – I mean, to say you love Sarah – you say people say, how do you feel about Sarah Palin? You say, well, I like her because I hate her enemy. It seems to me in some ways – to evade the central question. I mean, I could say, you know, I mean, I'm sure Louis Farrakhan gets a lot of bile from conservatives. So, you know, but it doesn't mean that I like Louis Farrakhan. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, from my point of view, the central question.
I wasn't making that as my primary defense of Sarah Palin. I was just saying that that's one of the reasons why a lot of people on the right are willing to defend her is because they think the attacks are so unfair.
Well, it seems to me, I mean, again, as an outsider, what strikes me is that you know, Republicans, you know, it's not just that people attack her; it's that she has become so good at playing the anti-elitist card in identifying Democrats, liberals, the media, you know, the liberal media as elitists, and that has been such an important part of conservative success in recent decades, is being able to find ways of putting sides on the side of cultural populism. On the other hand, it seems to me that one of the reasons that I think that, you know, a lot of that some conservative intellectuals would be, I would hope, would be nervous about her is that I wouldn't, you know, this anti-intellectualism, which seems to me is really central to who she is and her whole shtick, seems to me in some ways to run, you know, to be exactly the kind of thing that a conservative movement that has invested so much in intellectual institutions would not want to hitch up to. I mean, when I hear Sarah Palin talk, when I try to think of what Sarah Palin's definition of what a populist is, I mean, it's certainly not the big financial interest versus the little guy. It seems to me to mostly be the people with the fancy degrees versus the little guy. I mean, that's the way she defines it.
I don't know. I haven't heard her digress on the issue of definitions of populism, but. You know, look, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, let's talk about the Tea Party thing rather than Sarah Palin directly. You know, it seems to me that the Tea Party movement is probably not going to become a party, right? And, you know, it confuses some journalists who can't get over the word party, and I'm sure there are people within the Tea Party movement that want to make it a party. I mean, I know that there are. But it looks like it's going to be, however defined, a movement type thing. And I think while there are, you know, it's not a perfect analogy, the best analogy I can think of in terms of its role to the Republican Party is sort of like that of MoveOn.org to the Democratic Party. And
stiffening the spine kind of thing.
Stiffening the spine, getting people to go out and knock on doors, you know, let's not go wobbly kind of stuff. And, you know, the MoveOn.org kind of, you know, stuff was populism of a sort. And the Tea Party thing is populism of a sort. And it seems to me that a lot of the analysis that you're sort of tapping into about what would William F. Buckley think of all of this? You know, William F. Buckley liked a lot of bomb-throwing populists. William F. Buckley loved Rush Limbaugh. He loved J. Bracken Lee, who no one remembers now, but was sort of the Sarah Palin of the 1950s. The idea that somehow people who agree with you, this is sort of a Reagan rule kind of thing, people who agree with you on 8 out of 10 issues, who are providing all of this energy and enthusiasm and passion to, you know, a common cause, the idea that they should be written out because of some hypothetical position that there's no evidence that they actually have about anti-intellectualism and all. I mean, I'm not saying that there aren't anti-intellectual people on the right. I'm sure that there are. I believe that there are anti-intellectual people on the left. It's just when the left is anti-intellectual, they often make it sound as if it's an intellectual position. But the, you know, whether or not, you know, Sarah Palin is someone who can't fit within existing conservative institutions and all that kind of stuff, that simply remains to be seen. My hunch is that a lot of that stuff is just wildly overdone, by her liberal critics. And, you know, she's shrewd. I don't know that there's any evidence that she wants to, you know, I mean, she says she hasn't ruled out 2012, to run for president, but, lots of people do that when they want to sell books. Lots of people do that, for all sorts of mischievous reasons. Lots of people do that because it's the honest thing. But the idea that she's sort of this power hungry woman that was going to define the Republican Party and the conservative movement from now on, I think that's just moving way too many steps ahead of the game from where we are right now.
I would be amazed if the Republican Party would give its nomination to Sarah Palin. I mean, it just seems to me that
I doubt that too. I mean, I'm not saying it's impossible, but I would doubt it.
I mean, it seems to me it would really be the best analogy would be, I mean, I think she'd get killed in the general election. But I think the analogy would be to 72 with McGovern, not only in that regard, but I think it would be, I mean, you know, it would be one of these cases in which I think there was a grassroots eruption and a change in the way the process took place that overthrew the best laid plans of elites. And I just think that the Democrats actually have a history of doing that now, and then the Republican Party, I think it would be fascinating if Republicans do, because I think it's not the way the Republican Party usually operates. I mean, it just seems to me, you know, kind of Mitt Romney seems to be the classic kind of guy who would expect to get a Republican nomination. You know, he's paid his dues, he's become a better candidate, he's figured out how to kind of appeal to the different parts of the wings of the constituency. He's been a loyal soldier. You know, it just seems like everything I know about the way the Republican Party operates seems to me it would be, you know, he would be the natural guy to nominate. But.
Yeah, no, I think that's the way to bet. I mean, I'm not endorsing Romney right now or anything like that, but, you know, it also kind of depends how many people are in the field. You know, I mean, it seems to me that Palin has at minimum the sort of the Huckabee slice of the Republican base, right, the primary voters, and maybe, and maybe, you know, some of the McCain slice and some of the Paul slice. That's not bad going into a primary fight, and so the more people you have in the primary fight, the more significant your fraction of the pie gets. And so, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's so early to tell on all these sorts of things. It's entirely possible. I mean, it seems to me it's entirely possible that we're going to hear more and more analogies to the Goldwater movement in the Republican Party, you know, that Palin is sort of the Goldwaterite and all of the rest. And who knows? But in the meantime, you know, things are looking pretty good for my side.
No, you guys are going to have a good year, tragically. I think we should wrap it up.
Yeah, no, I just want to say one thing. On Sunday when you were on This Week, I hit info to see who was going to be on. I didn't know that you were going to be on. And on my cable, it pops up, and it just says Dick Cheney, George Will, Peter Beinart. And I was like, that's just an interesting lineup. So.
Yeah, well, you know, you can judge someone by the company they keep, I guess.
I guess so. All right, well,
All right,
have a
sir.
Good one.
Thank you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.